Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Sunday, Israel and Hamas agreed to another Egyptian-mediated 72-hour ceasefire. Today, tens of thousands of families in Gaza are returning to find demolished homes and entire neighborhoods turned to rubble. The United Nations is calling the latest assault on Gaza unprecedented. The assault has killed almost 2,000 Palestinians, 73% civilians. This is according to the Gaza Health Ministry and the UN. Over 757,000 Gazans have been displaced. 64 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have also been killed. Israeli Public Security Minister Yitzhak Aharonovich said that if talks to secure a permanent ceasefire lead nowhere, continuing the assault is the only option. Hamas chief Khaled Mashal has emphasized that a lasting truce will only happen when the Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip is lifted. So what can and should be done to end this humanitarian crisis? And what is the long-term view? Today we are joined by Muin Rabbani, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine and co-editor of Jadalia. Hi, Muin. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Tom Segev, an Israeli historian and a columnist for Haaretz. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Nice to have you. So for just over a month now, we've been watching the bombing and destruction of schools, homes, hospitals, and the loss of almost 2,000 lives in Gaza. Also, the firing of rockets into Israel. And as I said, 64 soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have been killed. Most of the coverage is focusing on the day-to-day and the cycles of the fragile ceasefire. But what we really want to do today is step back and understand what is behind these attacks and then take the long-term view. So, Muin, you recently wrote a piece in the London Review of Books in which you say that the conditions for the current assault on Gaza were set in late April. Can you talk about that? What is the backstory for this military operation in Gaza?
Well, the backstory has several aspects. It's related to the collapse of the latest American attempt to reach a comprehensive settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on Israeli terms, which the current Israeli government, which is the most extreme in Israeli history, refused because it will accept nothing short of the unconditional surrender of the Palestinians and an unconditional right to continue with colonial expansion in the occupied territories. More recently, there was a reconciliation agreement between the two chief Palestinian rivals, Fatah and Hamas, as a result of which they agreed a new government. And the Netanyahu government was very insistent on undermining and sabotaging this agreement and ensuring the continuing fragmentation of the Palestinian political system and the division, geographical division, between the West Bank and Gaza Strip. I think you can sum it up as divide and rule. And in that context, there was the disappearance of the 3 Israeli youths in the occupied West Bank. The Netanyahu government seized on this and immediately and without evidence claimed that this was an abduction conducted by Hamas in order to negotiate another prisoner exchange with Israel. It launched an organized military rampage throughout the West Bank and then began escalating its attacks against the Gaza Strip. What happened with respect to the Gaza Strip is that Hamas, which on previous occasions has kind of sat back and worked to prevent further escalation through retaliatory fire by either itself or other organizations, this time decided to meet the Israeli challenge head-on and not to shy away from further escalation because it was facing an extremely serious crisis of its own, which relates to the collapse of its relations with Egypt and basically the destruction of the underground tunnel economy between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, which was its lifeline to the world, on account of the 6 or 7 year old Israeli blockade. It had experienced a collapse of its relations with Syria. Its funding from Iran had more or less dried up. It was increasingly isolated regionally and internationally. Its popularity within the Gaza Strip was plummeting. And last but not least, the reconciliation agreement, which was for Hamas supposed to be a mechanism for it to be able to pay the salaries of its civil servants and to resume trade between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, had failed to achieve these goals, even though in this reconciliation agreement, Hamas basically capitulated to Fatah by accepting the quartet conditions and the continuation of security cooperation between the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Israel. So, in short, I would say that Israel was seeking to deflect potential international political pressure due to its categorical refusal to entertain an end to occupation. And Hamas met it escalation for escalation in order to resolve the underlying problems, first and foremost, the continuation of the illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip.
That is Muin Rabbani, a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a non-profit Arab research organization. Tom Segev, what are your thoughts on Muin's analysis of how we got to this place?
I could hardly say it better myself. I think it's a very good summary of what happened, a very good summary of the background, except that one thing is missing, and that's the fact that Hamas has been firing hundreds, maybe thousands of rockets on Israel, which have fortunately caused very little damage because we have this very sophisticated system of defense which shoots down rockets before they actually hit the target. But if any of those rockets had hit Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or those little towns along the Gaza border, we would probably have no less victims than the people in Gaza have now. But, you know, that's the background to a very ugly, very cruel, very dirty war, which I hope may be over. As we speak, Israeli and Palestinian teams are in Cairo. They don't talk face to face, but I think that Israel has a lot to offer the Palestinians at this time. And I hope that we don't miss the opportunity to do that. I understand that the negotiations are not simple. The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has to take into account strong opposition from extreme right ministers in his cabinet. Not all of them are extreme right, but some of them are extreme right people. Foreign minister, for example. And so the situation is not easy. Hamas has its own politics. There's a lot of politics involved here. I don't speak to you. You don't speak to me. I don't speak to Qatar. Qatar doesn't speak to Turkey or the other way around. And everybody wants to have a photograph of victory. Everybody wants to prove that they won. So some of it is quite childish, in fact. And the result is that there are tens of thousands of people in Gaza who lost their homes. Winter is approaching. And that's really a time to... Right now we have a ceasefire, which supposedly lasts until tomorrow night, our time. But we've had ceasefires before, and they were broken. So the situation is actually quite ugly.
Tom, how would you compare this assault to past assaults? The United Nations is calling this one unprecedented. And I mean, we have seen the bombing of homes, mosques, hospitals, ambulances. An estimated $5 billion worth of damage has been caused in Gaza. 475,000 people have been displaced with nowhere to go. Have you been surprised by just the extent of the damage and the sheer number of people who have been killed this time around?
Unfortunately, I've not been surprised because these things tend to get ugly very quickly. The damage is... The thing we know for sure is the number of people who got killed in Gaza and in Israel. And we know more or less how many refugees there are. I'm not sure how much it costs to repair. But I think that even if we do, if they do rebuild their homes, that's not enough. Gaza has been under an Israeli blockade for a very long time. It's really a huge prison camp. People in Gaza have no future, no hope, and the worst, they don't have anything to lose. And so I think it's very much in the interest of Israel to give them something to lose, because if you don't have anything to lose, you are likely to take those rockets, which you shouldn't have had in the first place, because they are a waste of money. You can build schools and hospitals and valuable other institutions instead of buying those rockets or digging those tunnels. So I think the people of Gaza need to have more to lose. And that's, I think, the challenge which the Israeli team in Cairo is facing right now.
Muin, what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think is the difference between this assault versus last assaults, past assaults?
Well, if I could just make two minor points first on the rocket fire. Mr. Segev referred to thousands of rockets being fired at Israel. And that is actually not accurate if we consider the period between the previous ceasefire agreement, which was in November or December 2012, and the spring. During that period, and according to testimonies from senior Israeli officers themselves, Hamas was seen as very effective in suppressing rocket fire by other Palestinian organizations, with few exceptions. And that really began to break down, I think, around December 2013, when Israel assassinated a jihadi figure in the Gaza Strip, who was actually leading an organization that's in rivalry with Hamas, but made it politically extremely difficult for Hamas to continue suppressing rocket fire by these other organizations. And the next development was in the context of the Israeli rampage through the West Bank this past June, when Hamas also then began launching mortars and rockets itself. My second point has to do with the reason that there were so few Israeli civilian casualties in Israeli cities, and I think this has very little to do with the Iron Dome defense system, which, according to specialists, is its effectiveness is vastly exaggerated and overblown. Fact of the matter is that these Palestinian rockets are largely locally produced. Secondly, their warheads have been downsized very significantly in order to increase their range. And thirdly, Israel has an excellent civil defense system in terms of bomb shelters and the like. And I think it's those factors, rather than the interception of the missiles, that accounts for the very low number of Israeli civilian casualties. Now, I've seen a few pictures of Palestinian rocket impacts on buildings in Israel, and you know, you would expect that such a rocket would take out at least one or two floors of a building. It appears not to even have seriously penetrated it, which I think, you know, demonstrates the rather primitive nature of these rockets, which I think are primarily designed to seek to paralyze daily and economic life in Israel rather than to inflict mass casualties, as with the bombs and rockets that Israel
has. Sounds like a real pleasure to be under these rockets. I would invite your listeners in San Francisco to imagine a rocket attack from Berkeley. even if they are primitive.
Well, you know, if Berkeley has been under occupation for half a century.
It doesn't matter how primitive they are. They are not that primitive. And as I say, one is enough to cause extreme damage in Tel Aviv. Fortunately, they have been shot down before they could hit. So,
well, again, I'm questioning
in open spaces and not have to be shot down. But you really present it as if it's just a little thing. It's not.
That's not the case at all.
You really can't live in a place like Sderot, which is a little town next to Gaza, an Israeli little town, if every few minutes you have to seek shelter, and I think you have 10 seconds or so to seek shelter, and then the rocket hits you or not. You can't live that way, and I don't think any country can tolerate a constant.
I believe you've misunderstood my point.
I think you people in Jordan would not tolerate it if that happened to you. Fortunately, Jordan is somewhat far away from Gaza, but Tel Aviv is very close. So you know, that's a problem. It's a real problem, and it's part of the problem, and apparently we are dealing with an organization which is willing to pay a very, very high price for its political goals. Hamas is really an awful dictatorship. And the people living in Gaza live on one hand the danger of Israeli bombardment, and on the other hand this Islamic dictatorship. So they are the real victims, the people there. But I really don't think that the attacks on the rocket attacks on Israel can be defended in any way.
Tom?
No, I think you misunderstood my point. What I said is there are compelling technical reasons that help explain the very low figure of Israeli civilian casualties in this conflict, and I'm certainly in no way suggesting that I would support a higher number of Israeli civilian casualties. Having said that, this constant argument, what if rockets were being shot at your country? Well, I think many people would also recognize that if your country was occupying another people for almost half a century, the prospects that you would be shot at would be relatively high, unless, you know, the expectation is that one can occupy and colonize foreign territory, and that the occupied and colonized people will pretend as if they're having the time of their lives. And, you know, in reality, that really has never happened throughout history, and is certainly not happening in this case either.
That is Muin Rabbani. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a nonprofit Arab research organization. He is also co-editor of Jadalia. They offer local knowledge and scholarship on the Middle East. We're also joined by Tom Segev, an Israeli historian and columnist for the Israeli Haaretz newspaper. Tom is also author of several books, including his latest, One Palestine Complete, Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate. And today we are talking about the current situation in Israel and Palestine. We're talking about how we got here and then taking the longer-term view. And if you have any questions for Muin Rabbani or Tom Segev, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we already have a few calls on the line, so let's hear from Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. I want to ask, every time there is a flare-up in this conflict, people ask, who threw the rocks yesterday? as if the problem started yesterday. One should go back, if not all the way to 1948, to the creation of Israel, at least go back to 6-7 years ago, when this blockade, this open air prison of the Palestinians started. So it's just and furthermore, why don't we call this Holocaust 2.0 a Holocaust? It's like a reverse Holocaust. What happened to the Jews in Germany is what's happening there in the Middle East. What is this euphemism? Why don't call a spade and call it a Holocaust? And of all the people that to perpetrate a Holocaust, that it would be the Zionists in Israel, it's really, really sad. And I'm not an Arab culture lover either. Look what they're doing to each other, the Arabs in Palestine, I mean, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
All right, well, thank you for calling in, Alex. We've got full lines, so I'll get a comment in just a minute. I just want to take a few more before we go to break. And again, if you have questions for Maureen Rabbani and Tom Segev, we would love to hear from you. Let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo.
Good morning, Rose. Thanks for the show. My question is about the negotiations. It seems like the thing is you have to do this before we do that, and on both sides. And I'm wondering who blinks first. Mr. Segev, you said that Israel has an opportunity now through these negotiations to perhaps start something, a chain of something that hasn't happened before. So I would just like to get your comments about that.
All right. Thank you, Mo. Let's hear next from Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Very quick comment, and then my question. My comment is this really truly is never looked at as a historical perspective. The Jews are in Israel from over 1,000 years of persecution, but does it resolve the issue by pushing one group out to take over another? We know that's not so. So what do we do? Historically, we progressed to what's supposed to be the United Nations, which is supposed to be the modern industrial nations of the world, banding together to prevent violence from occurring and unwarranted violence to resolve issues peacefully. And yet, we don't do that. Organization hasn't done one thing to stand together to say we all share responsibility for this. We share a responsibility for persecution for one group that created a situation where it felt obligated to go push out another group. And if we can't learn to resolve these issues using all the nations of the world to sit down and say we're taking responsibility and we're going to work together to find a collective answer to this question, how are you going to resolve it? Otherwise, it's perpetual, as one man said, who threw the first rock first? And it'll never be resolved.
And Brad, we almost have to go to break. Is that your main question? How will this be resolved?
When are we going to demand that what we proposed, theoretically, from the start of the century and then trying to reimpose in the 50s and the 60s, the modern industrial nations of the world sitting down and resolving, stepping in to resolve issues where violence did not create an answer to the solution?
All right. Thank you for calling in, Brad. And we'll get answers to your questions right after the break. Today, we are talking about the latest crisis in Gaza with Maureen Rabbani, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies and co-editor of Jadalia, and Tom Segev, an Israeli historian and columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And today, we are talking about what can and should be done to end the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the foundations for long-lasting peace. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio to join in today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC World Have Your Say, and following that at noon today, our weekly presentation of Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about whether tipping is good for workers. The federal tipped minimum wage is just $2.13 an hour. Tipped workers are three times as likely to live in poverty. So what are your thoughts on tipping? Should it change? And if you rely on tips, what changes would you like to see, if any? And then on Thursday, we'll have a conversation about successful corporate pressure campaigns. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the current situation in Israel and Palestine. On Sunday, Israel and Hamas agreed to another 72-hour ceasefire. Today, tens of thousands of families in Gaza are returning to find demolished homes and entire neighborhoods turned to rubble. The military assault has killed almost 2,000 Palestinians, 73% civilians. This is according to the Gaza Health Ministry and the UN. Over 475,000 Gazans have been displaced. 64 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians have also been killed. So today we are talking about what can and should be done to end this humanitarian crisis and what explains the latest assault. The UN is calling this unprecedented. We're talking about it today with Muin Rabbani, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies, a nonprofit Arab research organization. Muin is also co-editor of the e-zine Jadalia. Tom Segev is an Israeli historian and columnist for Haaretz. He's the author of several books, including One Palestine Complete: Jews and Arabs Under the British Mandate. So you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What questions do you have for Muin Rabbani and Tom Segev? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Mo had a question about negotiations, how they work, and who blinks first. Tom, do you want to take that first? What would you tell us about negotiations?
In general, you mean, or these particular ones? Because I know nothing about these particular ones. In fact, most Israeli cabinet ministers don't know anything about the current negotiations in Cairo, and they are protesting, but Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't tell them. So we don't really know. We know that they are working under time pressure. We know that the ceasefire is supposed to end tomorrow at midnight, our time. And I think from my impression is that both sides are trying to be serious about it. And as negotiations go, as a rule, no one wins. No one gets everything. And everybody has to give up something. In this particular case, it is so difficult because on both sides, politics play a role, and both sides have to come home and be able to say that they gained something, that they won something. As I said before, I think the most important thing is to make life more livable for the people in Gaza. And we have not only a humanitarian obligation to work for it. We also have a national interest to see that the people in Gaza finally get something to lose. And we have a lot to offer to them. We can open the passage between Gaza and the West Bank. We can let them come in and out through the sea and through the air in the direction of Egypt. And they have a lot to offer us. They have to give us an obligation that there is no more shooting, no more terror. And that would not solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It would be one chapter in a long, long effort to manage the conflict somehow. I belong to a majority of Israelis. Actually, in my long life, I belong for the first time in a majority in Israel, and this is a majority of people who no longer believe that peace is possible at this time. Mm-hmm. All we can do is to manage the situation. And I think it's so difficult to solve the conflict, in answer to some of your callers, because this is not about land or borders or water or what have you. It's a conflict about identity. You have two people here who define their national identities by the land, all of it. And the result is that any compromise would require at least one side to give up part of its identity, and that's apparently very, very difficult to do. The conflict has become much, much more difficult to solve, A, because of so many Israeli settlers in the West Bank. We have evacuated Gaza, as you know, but that brought us no good. And the other thing is that the conflict is becoming much more religious. God is really playing a very negative role in our conflict. And on both sides, actually, in Israel and among the Palestinians as well. And so the conflict becomes more and more difficult to solve all the time. So the best we can do is to manage it. Unfortunately, we are managing it very, very badly. Imagine the prime minister who sooner or later will have to explain how it happened that the Palestinians were able to gain so many rockets in the first place and dig the tunnels under our nose. How did that happen? This is something Netanyahu will have to explain, I think, because it happened under his time in office. But we have also failed to see how difficult life in that huge prison camp called Gaza has become for the people, and I think we really have an opportunity now to make life more livable.
I want to ask you later in the show about what's happening in Israeli society, but I wanted to stay on this question of negotiations. And Muin, what would you add to that? I mean, what does a fair negotiation mean in this case? You've got Egypt playing the role of mediator between Hamas and Israel. It is no fan of Hamas. And then you have the United States, which is a very close ally of Israel. Congress and U.S. Congress recently approved $225 million for the Iron Dome system. In late July, the United States provided Israel with tank rounds for grenade launchers. So what are your thoughts on this? Who's in a position to really mediate fairly, and what does that mean in this context?
Well, I'd make several points. The first is maybe in direct response to what Mr. Segev said. I think if you look at the history of this conflict, there's overwhelming evidence that it can't be managed, and that attempts to manage it lead only to escalation and further complication. So I think we really have only two real options. One is to resolve this conflict, and the other is to see it become more intractable with greater escalation on the basis of failed attempts to manage it. Now, in terms of mediation, I would make two points. First of all, Egypt is not mediating between Hamas and Israel. Egypt has basically, until very recently, severed all relations with Hamas, and it's mediating between a unified Palestinian delegation led by the Palestinian Authority and Israel, and in that capacity, basically leading indirect negotiations about this specific crisis, whose resolution is, I think, quite clear, which is a lifting rather than relaxation of the Israeli illegal Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip in exchange for effectively an indefinite truce of by Palestinian organizations in the Gaza Strip, but without their disarmament. And I think there are all kinds of formulas within that space that can be found, although, as Mr. Segev pointed out, it seems to be the case that while the Israeli prime minister and defense minister are probably leaning towards such a formula, they're getting all kinds of heat from even more extremist cabinet colleagues. And I think in broader perspective, there's a very clear solution to this entire conflict. There's a very clear international consensus on how this conflict should be resolved, and that involves an end to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, the establishment of a genuinely independent and sovereign Palestinian state in those territories, a just resolution of the refugee question, and that leading to Israeli and Palestinian states living side by side. As far as mediation of that is concerned, well, we've had exclusive American mediation, if one can call it that, for 2 decades plus, and it has been, to put it very mildly, thoroughly catastrophic, and has led to a situation in which many people, including Israeli pragmatists like Mr. Segev, are now concluding that there is no resolution possible to this conflict, because the U.S. is much more a party to this conflict than it is an effective mediator. And what's really needed here is for the international community to step up to the plate and to seek to effectuate its own consensus rather than subcontracting it to the strategic sponsor of one of the parties to the conflict.
Tom, what's your response to Moin's analysis?
I'm always somewhat intrigued when people in Jordan speak about the two-state solution, because there is one country in the world that already has a majority of Palestinians, and that's Jordan. So I would gladly see the West Bank and Gaza annexed to Jordan, including all Israeli settlers, and that's, of course, and make that into the Palestinian state together with Jordan. But I know that this is not a serious proposition. I'm only mentioning it because on paper, everything is possible. All solutions, all possible solutions are well known and have been discussed, and many of them have been tried out. The problem is that the most moderate Israelis and the most moderate Palestinians are not capable of agreeing on anything. So it's very easy to say end the occupation, but the geopolitical situation has changed since 1967. About 500,000 Israelis are now living in the West Bank. As I said, as far as I'm concerned, they could all be part of Jordan if we all agree on that. But they won't. And so the situation is much, much more complicated than the simple formula of saying end the occupation. By the way, this is exactly why the Israeli government is so happily repeating all the time that it is still committed to the two-state solution, because that sounds good, and that's nice to go on the talk shows and say, well, but we are for a two-state solution like the rest of the world. That's very nice, but how exactly you define these two states? And as I said before, since we all define our identities by all of the land, partition is probably impossible. Now, there are some intellectuals in America. I have been a guest professor at Berkeley, and I met some of them who advocate a one-state solution. Let's all live together. The problem is that most Israelis don't want to live with the Palestinians, and most Palestinians don't want to live with the Israelis in one state, because these are two very, very different peoples with different histories and different traditions and different religions and different basic values. And so most Palestinians don't want to live as Israelis, and most Israelis don't want, so that's not a good solution. So I run out of propositions, and all I know is let's try to make life as livable as possible in this very, very troubled, very, very crazy country, which, by the way, is located in a very, very tough neighborhood, as you know, and you've already mentioned what happens in Syria, what happens in Iraq these days. You have mentioned on the news before we began the human rights, the Human Watch report on Egypt. So if UN says that something is unprecedented, the precedents follow each other all day, every day, and each one is worse than the former. And so I've come to a point where I say the only thing we can do is to try and manage life in a way that it becomes more livable, first of all for the Palestinians. That's the best I can offer.
That is Tom Segev. He's an Israeli historian and columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. We're also joined by Muin Rabbani, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies and co-editor of the Jadalia e-zine. Muin, we've got a few emails from listeners who still want to talk about why this happened in the first place. Why have we seen so much destruction and so many people who have been killed? Some say, one listener says, can this destruction really be reduced to the firing of rockets? Because no rockets are being fired from the West Bank, and Israel keeps building settlements there. So what's the real reason behind this?
Yeah, on that point, and just to refer to a previous part of the conversation, I don't know why my personal circumstances are considered relevant to this discussion, but for the record, I'm not a Jordanian citizen. And I suspect that this proposal to insert 500,000 settlers into the Jordanian state based on my familiarity with the views of Jordanians will create a problem for Israel, at least as serious as that which it is facing with its occupation of the Palestinian territories. And second of all, regarding the two-state settlement and an end to occupation, I think a very persuasive case can be made that it has never been seriously attempted. The Oslo process was about consolidating Israeli control over the occupied territories rather than ending the occupation and seeking a two-state settlement. And thirdly, I would say, so long as this occupation continues, there can be no normal life for Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. And I think we've seen that very clearly during the past month. Now, regarding, if I understood your question correctly, about how come there has been such massive destruction and loss of life in the Gaza Strip, well, I think this reflects Israeli military doctrine in dealing with Palestinians. There are several principles here. The first is what the Israelis refer to as mowing the lawn, which means that one periodically has to go in and try to beat the hell out of the Palestinians or its other adversaries in order to remind them who's boss and keep them within a manageable size. And what we've seen when Israel mows the lawn is that the grass tends to be overwhelmingly civilian. Second of all, the Israelis have also announced what they call the Zahia Doctrine, which is a reference to the southern suburbs of Beirut, which is that when challenged militarily, Israel will go in and deliberately, with premeditated intent, cause massive destruction to civilian infrastructure. The idea being that as a result, the population is supposed to turn against the political leadership, and the political leadership is supposed to be diverted from confrontation to construction. Now, there's very extensive historical literature on area bombing and massive targeting of civilians and so on, and there's virtually no evidence that such military campaigns result in the general demoralization of the civilian population. If anything, the opposite. And I think the occupied territories are a very good example. You know, over the past few decades, when Palestinians marched against the occupation, they were arrested. When in response they began throwing stones, they were shot dead. So they graduated to Kalashnikovs, and their houses were targeted by Apache helicopters. And now we have this rocket fire, and who knows what may be next. I think, you know, one can make all kinds of observations about how the Palestinians have organized their resistance to Israeli occupation, and particularly about how they could do it in a more unified and more effective, using more unified and more effective methods, particularly through the mobilization of their greatest resource, which is their people. But when all is said and done, I think it's simply completely unrealistic to expect a population of some 5 million people to spend half a century under occupation, to see their land continually encroached upon and colonized, and to simply ignore it. I mean, it's almost a law of physics, which has been demonstrated again and again throughout history, throughout the planet.
That is Muin Rabbani, senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies. Oh, just a minute, Muin.
Yes,
I just wanted to go
sure.
to a couple emails and calls because we're almost out of time.
Okay.
Tom Segev is an Israeli historian and columnist for Haaretz. George writes, how can we begin to consider, quote, what can be done to end the crisis in Gaza, end quote, without addressing disproportionately the punishment delivered upon Gazans by Israelis? Thanks for the email, George. And let's go to a few more callers. Karen in Alameda. Hi, Karen.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Yeah, so Israel really is not targeting the tunnels. I'm just watching a live feed of they just blew up the soap factory. So they destroyed the water filtration plant. They bombed 60 mosques. They bombed and destroyed 3 United Nations schools and sanctuaries, incinerating and immolating children. They bombed schoolyards. They immolated children. They've killed about 2,500 Palestinians. About 7,000 are burned, including women and children. There's been a systematic genocide since 1947 and 1948 of going in and bulldozing Palestinian homes with people living in it, bulldozing their orchards, killing their children, killing their animals, bombing their fields, bombing their hospitals. They kill doctors. They bomb ambulances. So Netanyahu, and I'm Jewish, Netanyahu, in my opinion, is a homicidal maniac. That's what's going on. It's systematic. They can't even leave. They can't go. They've been in a lockdown. It's a large concentration camp. So they are just like fish in a barrel. They're being immolated, bombed, invaded, occupied, bulldozers, Apache helicopters, and Congress just voted unanimously to give the Israelis more weapons. I mean, this is what Hitler did in London during the Blitzkrieg. And let me tell you, Netanyahu is following right in the steps of the Nazis. And as I said, I am Jewish and I have many relatives in Israel. But this is a complete slaughter, attack, murderous situation that's going on. And we don't have one member of Congress saying anything at all or doing anything except feeding them more guns. We give Israel $10 million a day of tax dollars. And with that, they built that concentration camp wall, and they continually, and all those people that they did in the trade last year, that they traded Palestinian prisoners for one soldier or two soldiers, those people have all been rounded up and put back in prison. They're probably being beaten to death right now. That's my comment, Rose.
Karen,
and I really hope that people are listening to this, because this is a genocide that is taking place.
Can I ask you, Karen, what are you hearing from your relatives in Israel? Because it seems like the sentiments have drastically changed.
I don't talk to them because they are fundamentalist. We're not on the same wavelength. We have no common ground. I'm completely against Israel continuously taking Palestinian lands, Palestinian homes, bombing and killing. So I don't really talk to them about it. I just am watching the news and listening to shows like yours.
Well, and I was struck by Tom's comment saying that Israelis and Palestinians just, there's no way they're going to be able to get along. So why are we talking about the two-state solution? What are your thoughts on that? Karen, did we drop Karen? Oh, okay. Tom, do you want to jump in there? What's your response to Karen?
Well, it seems to me that your last caller is also a fundamentalist, but except for the style and some expressions, I basically agree. You know, I don't know how often you hear this kind of talk in America. If you read my newspaper, Haaretz, you can very often, and it's on the web in English, these are things which we very often say ourselves. And I agree that the Israeli reaction to the rocket bombings of Hamas is very disproportionate. There's no question about it. Of course, some of these rockets have been launched from schools and hospitals and other civilian neighborhoods, and so naturally some civilians got killed in account of that. But basically, we have done much too much shooting, and we have done much too much destruction, and I wish we hadn't. But what I wish now is that we find a way to improve the situation, help Gaza to live a better life. And it's not only about the rubbish which result from the latest war, but really in the long term, we need a long-term solution which would make it possible for, I'm thinking, for example, of a 16-year-old boy in Gaza. He has no future. Ahead of him. He has nothing to do. And so I would hope that we open this huge prison for some rays of hope.
And, Muin, we've got about 30 seconds. Final thoughts from you?
Well, I think the 16-year-old boy in Gaza and everyone else can have tremendous opportunities, but that requires a fundamental change, which is an end to occupation, the first step of which should be lifting entirely rather than relaxing this blockade. And there's really no way around resolving this conflict on the basis of the well-established international consensus.
Muin Rabbani is a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies and co-editor of Jadalia. Tom Segev is an Israeli historian and columnist for the Haaretz newspaper. Muin and Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Is tipping good for workers? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the history and cultural practice of tipping. The federal tipped minimum wage is only $2.13 an hour, and tipped workers are three times as likely to live in poverty. Is working for tips a way to boost compensation for great service, or does it open the door for exploitation by employers and customers? If you work for tips, would you prefer an alternative? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.